You're listening to 66.6 FM. Radio TOVH. The Flush.
Well, hi, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Toilet of Hell radio show. I'm Joe Thrashenkill. With me, I've got Jordan. Jordan, how you doing?
This is not a song. This is a tribute. You gotta believe me. And I wish you were there.
I figured that somebody would say that at some point on this episode. I did not expect it to be within the first 15 seconds, though.
I got to get it out of the way.
That's fair. Hey, we got Jordan here. We also got Brenicide with us.
Now all my jokes are gone.
Yep, that wiped the whole thing out. Sorry, guys.
No, there's plenty of jokes. We experienced a very silly thing, and I'm very excited to talk about it. I'm okay. I'm here. I'm ready. I am up, and I have had nothing but the Mountain Dew from last night. But, you know, when you don't really sleep the whole night, you just kind of lay in bed with your eyes closed and then suddenly open them and, you know, get on the old computer to do your thing, man. I mean, that's the most fresh you could really be.
Yeah, we had some super violent storms last night, so I drank way too much to sleep through them. And then here I am. I don't know if I actually slept.
I think there's a big difference between like sleep and unconsciousness.
Yeah, I definitely didn't experience the former. I only had the latter. I'm a zombie here today, and I'm excited about this episode and what we did here. So I'm going to try my best. I'm just going to use all my muscle memory to pull off a good podcast here.
You know, I was so excited about this show. I found a t-shirt and some gym shorts to put on just to celebrate all the fine young men we're going to be talking about today and their usual wardrobe.
Instead of recording while you're just nude in your own home.
Obviously.
Jordan, did you get well rested for this episode last night?
I mean, I sleep, but it's never restful sleep.
I don't know
the state of me now.
Well, I don't know who gets like good sleep every night. Like, I don't think anybody does. That's why half of the economy is selling sleep aids.
Yeah. Well, that's just funny you bring that up. My wife sleeps very well. She recently, well, for the longest time, because weed has been legal and it's just fun, we've been like using marijuana as a sleep aid. But
so you've been introducing a chemical dependency.
Yeah. But now
the
we just switched
medication
that.
To self-medication.
Right. Of course. But we switched over to melatonin and it does a much better job. It's not as fun, but it does a much better job.
I mean, I'm not trying to say that you're a liar or nothing. I'm just saying I've had melatonin before, and I don't feel nothing from it. Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Man, I'm a rhinoceros. I take two of the – we got, like, these little strawberry-flavored gummies. I take two of those things, and I'm gone.
Sometimes I smoke a little CBD bud, which gives me the feeling that I might have consumed some kind of chemical, even though I didn't. Right. And that helps a little bit.
No. They put that stuff in lotion, man. It doesn't do anything. It's like the most modern snake oil. It's just, I don't know. We tried that too for the longest time. Went to some holistic jackass and tried to. It's way too fucking expensive too.
Oh yeah, no, it's not. You know what? I'm not gonna ruin the magic. It only works if you believe it works. It's like, you know, fucking fairy dust or whatever. So yeah. I'm not trying to ruin anybody's day on this one.
I should be able to equip CBD oil in Red Dead Redemption 2.
what benefit would that have on the gameplay?
Well, I don't know. They just pretty much the whole gameplay works like you just have all these little tonics from old Western times, and they just do random things for your cowboy man, depending on what the game developer felt like, you know, the tonic was like how it was relevant to the game. Like snake oil makes it so that you can shoot people in slow motion better.
Okay. Can you get, like, Merc-prescribed cocaine in the game?
You can get cocaine gum. You just find it in people's, like, drawers and stuff or on their bodies after you shoot them. And you can just chew that, and it just gives you stamina, which makes sense.
I guess that does make sense.
Yeah.
Makes you, the internal monologue of the game just gets louder and doesn't ever stop.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying, fellas, and everybody listening, is that if you're having some problems with stamina, you're trying to, you know, keep your pace in a marathon or a 5K or whatever, cocaine.
And that's something you can take with you after this episode. Rather than dilly-dally here and talk a lot of mumbo-jumbo, I figure we should get to the point, right? No. How do we feel about that?
Nope.
No?
I've got time.
I'm
in a rush.
Yeah. But you're excited. You're excited. So let's get to it, because I don't want, you know, it's like when you're going to I don't know. It's like, imagine you're going to your local theme park, and your mom meets a work friend, and instead of going on a roller coaster, your mom and her work friend are just staying there fucking gabbing for like 45 minutes, and you have to stand there and watch.
That is kind of what this episode, what every episode we promise to do something on. We just, we agonize while you like stare at the Neo Geo cabinet, like, come on, let me go.
Let me play Metal Slug, Mom.
we did a thing. Jordan made a movie suggestion, one that I think might be his finest yet. Right now, if you go over to YouTube, don't do it after this episode. Don't do it right now. You know, you got to listen to the whole thing first. If you go over to YouTube.com, you can watch a documentary in full called Tribute that was released in 2001. And it is one of the wildest things I think I've seen in a while. And it's not, you know, there's no like murder or, you know, drug abuse or nothing like that. It's just the internal lives of middle-aged men as they experience the psychosis that comes with being in a band.
Better than Tiger.
How did you find this, Jordan?
See, I'm surprised that you guys didn't know about this movie, because I've seen it a whole bunch of times in the early 2000s when this came out. Like a lot of people, I had cable in my house, cable TV, and there was like an explosion of channels all of a sudden. It went from like 50 to like almost 200. And a lot of it was like the racing channel and the Catholic channel and things that, you know, you flip past quickly and never really watch. But we also got IFC and the Sundance channel, which are pretty much the same thing. But Sundance Channel and IFC would constantly play this movie. And it's one of those movies where you're flipping by and you're like, oh, I'll watch for a minute. And then you're engrossed for an hour and a half because it's a slow motion train wreck that you can't turn away from.
Yeah. Listeners might not know, but independent movies didn't used to be some director with a name you couldn't pronounce and then like an extremely famous actor doing something with less makeup than usual. It used to be that it was like a nobody director with nobody actors, possibly their friends, with a very poor camera, trying to make as artful of a movie as they could. And yeah, that's what IFC kind of dedicated a lot of its airtime to.
I guess this is the thing, you know, I didn't have cable. So all of this this collective knowledge that you guys have from that era, I'm completely missing. So you could just blow my mind with anything that you want to talk about from then.
It's essentially the Mandela effect.
Is that really what it is, though? Because I thought that, like, both parties had to have some kind of knowledge of it.
Well, yeah, it's just that, you know, Jordan and I misremember IFC. We're so convinced it was real, but really we're just talking about, you know, memories that were patched together by other people kind of talking about it. And we go, oh, yeah.
Well, maybe. I think IFC was real because I think that's the channel that Whitest Kids You Know came on.
It still exists. IFC still exists.
I know. Oh. It's the joke.
Oh.
I'm being again, silly.
Being still don't guy. Have cable. Yep. Tribute. What I love most about Tribute, this movie was released in 2001, appears to be recorded on a camcorder, and it just... It appears timeless in a way that is deeply confusing. There is no consistency with the fashion other than it is distinctly unfashionable.
I know guys that are the age of all these guys, and they all still look exactly like this. I just feel like once you hit 42, there's just a generic store you go to. I think it's Sears in the corner there, and you just – that's all the clothes you get to wear.
You get to buy jorts. You get to buy white New Balance. And you get to buy a ill-fitting tee from a classic rock band.
Or a sports team.
Mm. That too. That too.
Raiders.
I don't know where most of this film was shot. I know it was all around the United States. The only part that sticks out in any noticeable way is there is one band that's based in L.A. And the other ones are just kind of what I imagine Wisconsin to be.
Right. So we have Larger Than Life, which is the Kiss tribute act. They're from California. There's Sheer Heart Attack, which is the Queen's tribute, which is also from California. Then we have the Monkees tribute band, the Missing Links, who it's never super clear where they're from. And then we have the Judas Priest cover band Bloodstone, which is from Albany, New York.
Okay. I would have sworn that the Priest band was somewhere in Wisconsin, but I guess Albany is the same kind of vibe.
It's like eastern Wisconsin.
So the whole thing about tribute is it follows these guys that are in more or less professional tribute bands to classic rock favorites like Kiss and Queen, I guess, if you're considering that a classic rock band. And the defining feature between all of these groups is that the people in it are insane. Just absolutely, their brains are gone off that rock and roll juice, which I think is just a fascinating phenomenon, and so did the director, because we get to marinate in that for an hour and a half. We've talked about this over and over on the show, about ways that you can actually make money in the music industry. I'd say the most reliable one is be in a decent cover band. Would you agree with that?
I would. I think there's levels of doing it, because you can be in a cover band that just plays different songs from different bands, mm-hmm. like a 90s alt rock tribute band. You go and you play in a nice bar and you do a Sponge song, you do Candlebox, you do the hits that people know. Yeah. Then there's the next level, which is a cover band of just one band, like Rage Against the Machine or Linkin Park or something like that. And then the top tier level is you dress up like them. You wear wigs, you wear costumes, you get big elaborate stage sets, and that's when you become a like full-on tribute act.
Certainly, and probably the greatest tribute act of all time is a little band called Slipknot, and they're just Slipknot like without a K. So
there's Slip-NOT. I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yeah, wow, excellent.
And they actually have a music video that's on YouTube, which is insane because it's not your song.
Where is Slipknot based out of?
I think they're kind of more local to us, which is why we know about it. It's more of an Asian thing.
Yeah, I think they were like Massachusetts, but they would go on tour. They would play in Connecticut and Rhode Island and New York and actually like get in a van and dress up like someone else and play someone else's songs.
So they and they do all the masks. They do all the jumpsuits. They actually put a lot of effort into it. And I feel like if you want to do a tribute band, a really great way to do it is to rely on one of these bands that has a gimmick like that. Mm-hmm. As we see definitely in this movie, but specifically, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but he's the guy that has all the spikes on his head, and just does like sample work and stuff for the band in the background.
The DJ.
No, not Sid Wilson. The other guy, Craig.
Something? Craig Fenn.
No, that's Chris Fenn. He's the long nose guy that just quit the band.
This is the spiky guy. I know
the spiky guy. Yeah. So they have spiky guy and Slipknot, but he doesn't actually have like sample equipment. He just kind of sits by some milk crates and bobs his head.
Oh, that's the best gig in the band.
Yeah. he's the most popular too.
Huh. Okay. Have you got, I feel like this episode was inspired a little bit because I sent Jordan this Twitter thread of a collection of Tool cover bands.
Yes.
Which was just a monument to sadness.
It was recently in the news, yeah. Just all of these photographs. So if you were to Google Tool cover bands right now, you'd probably get a couple articles that show all these photographs. And yeah, they're something. They're fun.
There are more, let's just say this, there are more Tool cover bands than you think there are.
There are more Tool cover bands than there are Tool albums.
By a factor of many. Have you guys ever gone, like, intentionally gone to see a cover band?
Not once, no.
No.
I did once. I went to see Guided by Voices, and I got a free ticket to see a Guided by Voices cover band the next night. And, wow. Yeah, I went, and it was pretty good. I had a good time.
You just didn't have enough Guided by Voices in that weekend that you just had to go see a cover band?
Guided by Voices have more than 1,000 songs, so it's like, I mean, you couldn't hear all of them in one show, so you might as well go the second night and hear the other ones.
Yeah, so they just need multiple bands to cover all the different songs.
Which makes sense in a way, you know? That one kind of makes sense to me, I guess, as much as doing this can. But for the, you know, if it wasn't a free ticket, I probably would not have gone to this.
Well, I think one of the really great things about this film is I had a question before I started watching it. And that question was, what kind of complete fucking extremely sad maniac would purposefully become like a fan of some like middle-aged dudes playing in a cover band?
I'm really glad that this documentary answered the question completely.
Yeah.
Let's, do we want, yeah, we can go ahead and, cause it doesn't matter so much the layout in this. Let's talk about, Sheer Heart Attack. And specifically we'll talk about Superfan, a fan of the band that is profiled, in depth. Instead of the band being profiled in depth, it's we talked to their biggest supporter, and it's pretty fucking uncomfortable, man.
This guy, I just like, I had to leave the room this guy was in, even though he really wasn't in there with me. He was very strange.
He looks like Kenneth the Page from 30 Rock, if you've ever seen that show, that actor.
Yeah, I was gonna say he reminds me of Sherman from American Pie.
Yeah,
we got a cross section of Kenneth and Sherman there.
Yeah, he just has like a really uncomfortable posture, and his eye contact isn't quite right, and I just feel like he's got serial killer written all over him in some really strange way. Like he collects lost women's bones in the same way that he collects like Queen merchandise.
We visit Superfan in his incredibly single apartment.
Yes, and by the way, when we call him Superfan, that is a distinction that he has himself. We're not just making,
yes.
That's the movie outlines that he is known as Superfan.
He has a little display shelf in his Hungry Man apartment that has.
I'm going to use that phrase for the rest of my life. Thank you.
It has some knickknacks, including this like piece of shit plastic clock that has goddammit,
Freddie Mercury.
Freddie Mercury. Like a Lucite Freddie Mercury clock, and Superfan says that he traveled to Italy specifically to buy this thing.
This is something you could buy on eBay for $5.
Yeah, this is coming out of like the Chinese bulk catalog. So I don't know. I'm glad he made that trip, though. He says that, you know, among other fans of Queen, he is known as listening to more Queen records more often than the other guys. So sometimes he lights a little incense next to that Freddie Mercury clock and just gets into ogre battle, I guess.
Indulge me briefly. I just want to type in Queen Clock and see what comes up.
Okay.
Wow, you can get some really good ones.
Really?
Yeah, you can get like ones that are, you know, they're like vinyl records.
These are way better.
Yeah.
These
are extremely better.
The one with
this was 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's fair.
More like super dipshit. Should just wait 20 years, dumbass.
That is a straight poverty clock, though, man. That is bad. yeah, these are pretty good. If I liked Queen even a little bit, these would be neat, but I don't.
Why not? What's not to like about Queen?
No, I think we even did this on an episode pretty recently. I don't like Queen. I feel like their fans annoy me because they're the same. They're the same people that get like their sense of humor from like Reddit. It's just Queen is the epic band, right?
I don't know. It's like a mastery in musicality where it wasn't before in rock history. But yeah, I guess they suck. Whatever.
It's not for me, dude. It's not for me. That's it. Okay.
All right. Okay.
I think
also Reddit's funny. Just kidding. No, I would never. I would never cross that line. Even when it came out of my mouth as a joke, I felt immediately offensive for it. So I apologize, listener.
I like the song "Fat Bottom Girls." That's the credit I'll give you.
Great.
Anyway, what's your favorite Queen record?
Man, I don't know. I like all the songs they play on the classic rock radio station that everybody's got in their general area.
Gotcha. I don't like those. I guess that's where the divide is.
I like Bicycle. That's a fucking B-side. I love it.
Jordan, which one's the good one?
Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
If I like, that's the thing. The same thing with like, Don't Stop Believing. Like, I never want to hear it again.
Can we stop you? Because I had taken a note, a really good serious note here about Enrique. So at a certain point in the... Now Enrique is the vocalist for this Queen cover band, Sheer Heart Attack.
Yeah.
Sheer Heart Attack. So Enrique, he's really fit.
He is a fit dude.
Yeah, he's not a bad-looking dude. And he looks nothing like Freddie Mercury, though. And I assume that the people running the documentary asked him about that. And he said, like, well, look, no one's ever going to replace Freddie. There's no reason to try. And outside of, like, false teeth and plastic surgery, I don't think I'd get anywhere close. But honest to God, all he really needs is a mustache and a haircut, and I think he'd be fine.
Yeah. I feel like it was either laziness or pride on his part that he didn't have a mustache.
Now, the reason I stopped you the moment you said Don't Stop Believing is because he would make an excellent Steve Perry from Journey.
He is too fit to be Steve Perry.
Maybe like a very, very young Steve Perry.
That might check out.
Which is the goal with these kinds of aesthetics for cover bands anyway.
So for the most part with Sheer Heart Attack section, we're following Superfan and his parasocial relationship with the band. But we do meet with the band slightly, mostly with their vocalist that leaves rather abruptly because he got an offer to perform in Cats in Hamburg, Germany.
Fucking good for him, though.
They popped that up on the screen. I legitimately said that, like, good for that guy.
Yeah, I was like, sick, he got out, man. He made it out alive.
Can we talk about show night?
Oh yeah, sure.
Jordan, do you want to carry us through Superfan's reaction to a Sheer Heart Attack show?
So Superfan has to lay out all of his Queen shirts. Is like special edition rare Freddie Mercury shirt, and these shirts are all crisp. They're not wrinkled. Yeah. They're not well worn. This is like just show night shirts, and he lays out his very nice looking Sheer Heart Attack shirt, which he's going to wear tonight. He then receives a phone call, presumably from his one friend,
in hello, which concert.
his concert buddy, and he says he has pre-show jitters. He hasn't eaten all day, and he's just really nervous. And you know, he'll see him there. He's ready. He's ready to see Sheer Heart.
I want you to show up in a timely fashion. You know, like, this is extremely important to me.
Yes. Also, bring all of our friends.
He looks right at the camera. Yes, all of our friends, please.
We get a just the briefest glimpse of his concert buddy, which is just some guy with his wife, literally no one else.
Did Superfan, was he the one that stepped out of the Camaro that said like Dragon King or something on the license plate?
I might have missed that entirely.
Because I thought when that, because the movie didn't really introduce, it was like the very first shot of Superfan. I think it was Superfan stepping out of this Camaro, and it just said like Dragon Lord or Dragon King or something abbreviated on a license plate. And this was 2001, so this was a brand new Camaro at that point. And I assumed it was like a band member. And I was like, dude, why even worry? You're already living the dream right now. Like, I would fucking love to have a Camaro with a novelty license plate.
I'm bummed that I missed that key detail. Superfan, I guess, has done all right for himself. He's certainly not spending money on other people.
Oh, you can tell this guy's like a programmer or like a network administrator, like someone who's got nearly a six-figure job, if not a six-figure job, especially back in like 2001, especially if he's able to like purchase a ticket to fucking Italy, which is like a bucket list things for so many people, just so he can pick up a plastic shitty novelty clock.
Italy is known for incredible replicas of plastic novelty clocks, man, I guess.
I'm sorry about the tangent, but for people watching the film, look forward to the Camaro.
Okay, that's a good note there. So he watches the show. He's, you know, finally nutted. He's relaxed. He's at peace. And then we get the note that Enrique is going to be moving to Hamburg. And
he's going to be Rum Tum Tugger.
Is that the role that he was supposed to be?
That they never expressed it, but I mean, what else could the singer from a Queen tribute be in Cats other than Rum Tum Tugger?
Mr. Mephistopheles. I don't know anything about Cats, man. So the future of the band is in question, and you know, this is pretty difficult for everybody involved, for Superfan, for the other guys in the band. And it seems like if you have a tribute band for Queen, losing Freddie Mercury is, you know, that's kind of the important one, right?
No. How many Freddie? You know, there are a dime a dozen.
So the band decides to hold a tryout to possibly replace Enrique. Man, if this isn't the whole process of like trying to play with someone new, I don't know what it is. They just have the poster. If you had to look in the dictionary and look at schlub, the picture of this guy would appear. just a dad. He's got, you know, a normal skinny frame with a giant belly in the middle. Just an unassuming 40-something-year-old guy, and they're trying to jam, and it doesn't work.
And the thing is, they're all fat 40-year-old guys. And then they just, like, as this guy leaves the audition, they just proceed to, you know, bash him about his size. But, yeah, I mean, I think they do share some self-realization of their own fatness at the same time. But Freddie Mercury wasn't fat, so, you know, can't have it, dude.
I enjoyed the conversation afterwards. Like, I mean, he's got potential, but I don't want potential. Christ, man, I'm 40 years old.
This is not what we're doing, man.
It's not it. It's not it, bro.
Yeah.
That's essentially the end of Sheer Heart Attack. Unable to find a replacement for Freddie Mercury. In the closing notes of the movie, they note that this band went on to become a Deep Purple cover band.
Do you think they just were able to do that without a new vocalist at all, or do you think they got somebody?
Could you recognize the vocalists of Deep Purple?
No.
They just got a puffy shirt, and they had their Ritchie Blackmore, and we're fine.
Yep, that's it.
Nobody gonna take my car. I can do it. Fuck it.
Let's sign you up, bro.
Thanks, man. Just call these guys. Hopefully 20 years later, their tickers are still ticking.
So thus ends the thread of one major piece of this tapestry. What's the next band that we ought to focus on?
We really got to talk. It's Larger Than Life, right? The Kiss band.
Larger Than Life is really the heroes of this whole thing.
We should the thing is the Rob Halford cover band. I'm sorry, not Rob.
Bloodstone.
Yeah. They were probably the most underwhelming in terms of story. They were just a bunch of guys they showed kind of the working class situations that a lot of these guys were in more than anything, and just talking about how fucking unhappy they were to be at the jobs they were at. One of them's a mailman. The other one
that was just a fan. Yeah, he wasn't in the band.
Oh, it wasn't. I thought it was one of the guys.
Heavy metal mailman.
Oh,
yeah. Heavy metal mailman kicked ass.
I misremembered then. But specifically Tire Guy.
Tire Guy, I felt more empathy for Tire Guy than anybody else in the entire movie.
Of course. Like immediately I heard Tire Guy talking and I'm like, that's it. We are all Tire Guy. You know? He's just like, I'd rather be playing guitar instead of doing something I don't want to fucking do. And one of my friends into Buddhism told me that when you're doing something that you don't want to do, just do it. Don't think about it.
It's just it's tough. What guy was he in the band, by the way? Was he
he was a guitarist.
Guitarist, okay. Yeah.
He was he KK or it doesn't matter.
Glenn Tipton?
I think he was KK.
No, I don't know.
He was KK Tipton.
Yeah, KK Tipton.
Not Rob Halford.
He's talking about basically how he wanted to be a rock star and he kind of lived his life in that manner. He didn't much care about anything, didn't think about the next day, was partying too much. He got wasted, wrecked his friend's car, got charged with the DUI, was facing jail time. His brother killed himself in that same period. He found himself unemployed without anywhere to go, facing jail without his brother, and just realizing this has been a bad path for me. I need to change my ways. He's talking about getting sober, finding some solace in the menial work that he does, and then really focusing and enjoying on his time playing in the Judas Priest cover band. It's like, yeah, man, that's great. It's also worth noting that out of all of the bands featured, I think Bloodstone is the one that was probably pulling in the least amount of money for doing their shows. That's the vibe I got anyway. What do you guys think?
Go ahead.
That's what it looked like.
Yeah. And I think Judas Priest, I know this sounds insane to talk about in the context of metal, Judas Priest is probably like the least popular among all the groups covered, specifically in this documentary. So I could definitely see that, like, you know, a bunch of aging metalheads is probably not as wide of a market as some of these other bands like Queen and the Monkees and everything else. I remember the vocalist specifically, kind of this chubby bald guy. There was this.
He did look a bit like a thumb.
Yeah, not the chubby bald guy that we all know and love, who covered Judas Priest famously. Different guy. So
it's like if you took Rob Halford and squished him down.
Yeah, and like an MS Paint.
Made him a sad dad from upstate New York.
One of my favorite scenes of the movie is that he's just standing there in his kitchen with his children, and his children are being like very normal toddlers, just like not even making more noise than most toddlers would any given minute of their lives, and he's just seething in the corner, like, he's like, I'm really glad I'm a happy-go-lucky guy.
He hates his family.
Well, like, as his children are having like a little child fight, he's trying to explain to his wife about how like one of their shows was canceled. And, like, they have a booking agent. It's just like, be a dad. Be a dad for 5 minutes.
Yeah, that was a little bit tough to watch, actually. This guy that is, you know, he's in his place in life where he's in his, well, he might not be 40 yet, but he's, you know, married. He's got like a family. Yeah, he's married. He's got a family. He's got a job, presumably. And he's just, he can't stop thinking about, like, what if I were a rock star instead?
And that's a theme throughout the whole movie, is a lot of, like, missed opportunities, and it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Kind of like the Anvil documentary, but even sadder.
With Bloodstone, it's notable that they go on a bit of a tirade, focusing on a friend of ours, Ole Rippey. there's talk about Ole Rippey and how he, you know, he's a true American hero.
The American dream is what someone says.
Yeah, I loved the segment where we're talking to Ole Rippey's old coworkers at the fucking stationery factory or whatever the fuck.
I think it was a law office, and he was like the runner to get them supplies.
Yeah, which it is incredible to me that was, I guess the economy has gotten so fucking bad that I can't imagine this still being a job nowadays where. Ole Rippey's job was to go down to the stock room, grab a notepad, bring you up to the seventh floor, and then go back down, get more notepads for other floors.
Well, it's probably like a mail job, to be honest, and they just didn't want to say that.
I guess that makes sense.
At my last job, I feel like that was my actual job. It just sounds like I was the mail guy more than fucking anything. Like, I was supposed to be, you know, repairing things and building things, but they had an entire, you know, brand new business that they weren't running properly, and things needed to physically happen that were never happening. So I was always doing that shit. I would really like it if we had one of those fucking guys. Tim, call me, you know?
I guess every job I've ever had, it's like, if you need supplies, go get it yourself, asshole.
Yeah. Right.
So all of Ole Rippey's coworkers are talking about, you know, just what a fantastic, you know, success story that he is. And the vocalist of Bloodstone is just quietly fucking seething.
He's talking about the story, which was actually recreated in the movie Rockstar with Mark Wahlberg, about how supposedly Ripper sang one line of a song and hit a very high note, and the band like stopped everything and was like, when would you like to join? And this guy's like, it wasn't even that high. It wasn't even that good. I could do that. Whatever.
Pretty sour grapes, if you ask me. I don't know that I was blown away by Bloodstone's vocalist myself.
No. I think he was fine.
Yeah, he was okay. Yeah.
Better than like your average person who thinks they can hit some of those notes. He could hit some of those notes. You know, I guess we don't see enough to really hear some diversity or get a full grasp of his repertoire. But fine, acceptable. I wouldn't walk out if I had to sit through it.
I did enjoy the show that they played, though, just with a bunch of 50-year-old mechanics losing their mind in the front row.
That sounds about right for upstate New York tribute, I mean, band watching.
Yeah,
it was great though. Like, those guys were into it. Unfortunately, you can't extrapolate the 50-year-old guys in your local scene to create a national following.
I guess my issue with the Judas Priest band is that Judas Priest, I mean, certainly. I mean, I'm stopping myself now because I realized during that time, I don't know if Rob Halford was still in the band. I think he was doing like Fight and his own solo career and things like that. But I don't know. Judas Priest, I feel like they never stopped touring, and it's really not that hard to see them in a place like New York. But
yeah, I think with some of these tribute acts and playing shows, it's really because Judas Priest isn't really ever going to play Albany or Binghamton all that much. So it's people's chance to see the songs they like and really an excuse to get hammered and listen to music.
To that, I retort, I saw them in Lowell, Massachusetts. So.
The only familiarity I have with Lowell is The Fighter and the HBO documentary on crack that like inspired The Fighter.
Was that High on Crack Street?
Yeah, or something like High on Shattered Street or some shit like that.
I think it's High on Crack Street, and I only know about it because my friend's couch was featured in that movie at one point.
God damn, that couch seems like it would be unsanitary.
Well, I feel like High on Crack Street is a great segue into getting into the stars of this film.
Well, do we want to get into the stars, or do we want to get the Monkees tribute band over with?
Let's get the Monkees over with. Let's rip
that Band-Aid off. You're right. But I'm sorry.
I had a good time with the Monkees band, yeah. Though. It's not the star of the attraction, but I would be remiss if we didn't talk about it just a little bit.
Oh, I mean, you could honestly do a movie just about them and just the sheer weirdness amongst all of them.
So there are two major figures in the former Monkees tribute band. There is one guy that's the Davy Jones, right?
Yep.
Yeah. He kind of looks and sounds like Davy Jones. I'll give him credit. And then the other guy is Dwight Yoakam. and I love how much Dwight Yoakam fucking hated the Davy Jones guy.
I mean, really, all of the cursing that you hear in the movie is almost from him talking about the Davy Jones guy.
It is incredible. We get to follow him driving around in this shitty Tercel, just seething about how much he fucked him over.
They had plans to like move to Nebraska and get like houses next to each other, and then it all fell apart.
Yeah, apparently some big egos.
Big egos in the Monkees tribute.
Yeah.
What was it? The Missing Links, was that what it was?
That was it, yeah. Specifically what happened was the guy who, this Davy Jones fella for the Missing Links, he had a Beatles outfit as well that apparently was a lot more popular because the Beatles usually are. And what they were doing was he was actively canceling the Monkees band gigs and replacing those exact same time slots with the Beatles tribute band he was doing. And it made it so that this Dwight Yoakam character you're talking about, he said he was like, it made me want to smash his fucking head in with a guitar.
For the most part, people in this movie have a kind of like strange Midwestern niceness to them. That is all out the window with these fellas.
Yeah.
We have Dwight Yoakam. I really enjoyed watching him set up a band practice with a new cast of characters. He was like, "We're not a fucking costume band. We're a vocal melody band. Turn down your goddamn guitar."
He had a vision.
He did, and they sounded pretty good. Like I thought they sounded nice. That's one man's take, though. What did you guys think?
I thought most every band featured here sounded pretty good.
Yeah, there was no bad band. It wasn't like you guys have to stop right now.
I guess I was most impressed by Dwight Yoakam's Monkees because he did understand like what it was that they needed to sound like entirely, like turn down the guitars, focus on your vocal melodies. And it's like, yeah, he's right. The closing notes on these were really interesting in that, you know, for all of the venom that Dwight is spitting in this thing, he went on to like direct and produce a TV documentary on the Monkees.
I mean, it was never stated if that actually was shown anywhere. He might have just done it and it was never on TV or in a movie.
That's fair. I'd like to believe that it was a huge success.
Yeah.
Whereas Davy Jones, his closing note was that he was dropped by his booking agent.
It's important to state what his dragon lady referred herself as, what name she used. And that was Dragon Lady, which is a racial epithet.
Yeah, it's a white lady who likes putting chopsticks in her hair and wearing like jade dresses and shit. I didn't quite understand that one, to be honest with you.
She was like the promoter for the band, and she was playing real fucking hardball at the kitchen table at one point in the movie, like talking about how she's like, this is a 911 call. This needs to be fixed right now, about times that this guy's shitty Beatles cover band was going to be playing.
Yeah, it's you're getting three bands for the price of one. You're twisting my balls here, bro.
You're breaking my balls. You're breaking my balls.
We did have a segment in the beginning with the Dragon Lady where she's explaining what it is to be in a tribute band. She has a lot of opinions on this. You gotta be dedicated. You have to become the characters in the band itself. It's not just enough to put on a costume. You have to be them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's really where we get to the meat of this whole fucking thing. I think we put it off long enough. Can we talk about Larger Than Life?
No, please. I don't want to anymore.
Everyone's favorite band, Kiss. Can you believe that they have tribute bands? I mean, there's probably like three local to me.
Maybe a couple here or there.
There's Mindy Kiss, which is probably the most well-known one.
Yeah, which is the band of short people that dress up as members of Kiss. There's several lady Kisses. There's a lot of variations you can get with Kiss.
Yeah, there's the Lady Judas Priest cover band, Judas Priestess.
Oh yeah,
and the Iron Maidens.
Mm-hmm.
That's its own gimmick, a gimmick within a gimmick.
There's also like CDC or something like that. There's a lot of permutations of this whole thing. I think that what makes Kiss unique is that they kind of encourage these kinds of things, I suppose, because they get dividends from each tribute band. but Larger Than Life, this is a Northern Californian band, I guess.
I don't remember.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter.
We're introduced to two guys that are talking about their history in music. We get to hear a brief section of music from their original band from 1987, which sounded like pretty sweet hair metal. And they talk about, you know, kind of getting bumped around a little bit, things not working out so great.
Didn't they have an awesome name, too? It was like Lethal Weapon or some shit. I can't remember, but it was like a really good, no, it was like Villain. I think it was.
That's pretty tight.
Yeah, it's like a tight 80s band name. I was like, that's cool. I'll have to look that up on Metal Archives and see how they're doing.
And you know, they kind of bumped around from cover band to cover band. Didn't really work out. They focus on, what was their Tim and Eric looking band called?
I don't remember the name of it, but it was like a mom and dad jazz band.
Yeah, there were like 15 members of it, though, and everybody looked exactly like Tim and Eric, just some permutation of a Tim and Eric character.
And these two guys that are in the Kiss cover band, I believe it's the guitarist and the drummer, they look more like this Tim and Eric band. Like they fit in perfectly with that more than they would a Kiss band.
It really is, and it is a testament to how much wearing a suit of armor and makeup can do for you to change your image from just a weird dumpy dad to some kind of a rock and roll creature. We also get to focus a bit on the founders of Larger Than Life, which is we have our Gene Simmons, which is Alex. Was that his name?
They referred to him as Patchy. That's right. It was like Andy, but Patchy, they called him.
Yeah. We also have our Paul Stanley, who's an African-American fellow who is serious about Kiss. He's got a lot of opinions on other Kiss tribute bands, and that he's not a fan. They're apparently not very good.
They don't put in the effort that he does with stage shows and the makeup and the costumes, and he's all about the music too.
Yeah, that's the thing. You can't just have, you know, the costumes and the fire. You have to know the music. You have to play it well, which, you know, I don't think Kiss even bothers with that. So good on him. Patchy, the Gene Simmons fella, has I got to the first 8 minutes of this documentary. I immediately stopped it after his first interview segment. I was like, I have to make my wife watch this with me.
Yeah.
Where Pakshi is describing other guys and other Kiss tribute bands that play Gene Simmons, and he's like, I don't know, man. I think they're a bunch of assholes. You know,
they take themselves too seriously and they think they are Gene Simmons.
And then he just says, wait, what was the question again? Yeah. I was like, oh, this is perfect. This is the best thing.
He's like, you got to make sure that you don't get lost in yourself. You don't lose yourself in the image of the person that you're playing.
Which is incredible foreshadowing, I guess. Because I guess about 45 minutes later in the documentary.
45 minutes later in life.
The other members of Larger Than Life are talking about, like, yeah, I got these calls that Pakshi is, you know, his house was burned down. He was locked up. Apparently it was arson. He had lit a fire in every room of his house. He was hearing demons. He was seeing things. He was convinced that he was Gene Simmons and that he was possessed by the devil. And I just, it's so fucking wild to me. I know what image Gene Simmons has on stage, but I can't even look at that because I know what Gene Simmons is in real life.
Yeah. Like, the evil of Satan doesn't even cover Gene Simmons.
He's just the most ruthless money manager on earth. And that's his entire character. That's all he has going for him.
And some spiky boots, dude. It's like, how could you, like, that was so interesting to me. Like, that blew my mind, that just the whole image of Gene Simmons is so evil and dark that it could corrupt someone's soul. It's like, this guy's just a fucking grifter in some makeup. Like, that's all he's ever been.
This guy has fucked over every person he's ever known because he thought he would get a dollar out of it.
Right.
I think there's like a strong correlation throughout this movie, and I guess bigger in the tribute act areas, kind of this failed musician, like, didn't quite make it, wants to be a star, but it's never going to happen. And then people having this like psychotic break and becoming whoever they're portraying. They're like, they're a loser in real life, but when they're on stage, they actually become Gene Simmons. They have the makeup. People are excited to see them. When they get off stage, people refer to them as Gene. So I guess I could see, like, it makes sense where this might happen, where someone starts mentally getting into like one sort of mind frame and that kind of taking over and kind of pushing people who are already in a dark place over the edge.
I think you really nailed it there.
Yeah.
And the way that this kind of all personifies itself is Pakshi's out of the band. They have to call up a former band member of Paul Stanley character.
Can I stop you?
Yes,
please. You're skipping over the best part of the movie.
Oh, go ahead.
And yeah. Is the most Spinal Tap-ish part of the movie.
I didn't even know if this scene was real. It was too cinematically perfect.
So they're trying out someone else to fill in the Gene Simmons role, and this guy is a lunatic among like sad, crazy people. He's jumping around. They're practicing in someone's house, and this guy is just sweating and bouncing around and sticking his tongue out, and the
in like Paul Stanley, people's faces. Yeah,
the Paul Stanley guy's like, we just want to hear you play. Like, don't worry about all the other mannerisms and stuff. We just want to hear what you can do. And this guy like can't play bass. Everyone stops playing, and he just keeps going and is making faces. And everyone else in the band is just like, oh, my God, get him.
He's just getting up in their faces, like getting right up in their faces and like playing bass right in the face. And it's just clearly pissing everybody off.
And this is someone who just met them.
And the camera just cuts to every single, there's like a montage of everybody's face looking at this guy perform. And it's just, it's probably like the most cinematic moment in like rockumentary history. Like, nothing has ever been captured so great than how these people are just looking at this guy try to play bass. And I thought what was the most interesting part is they told him like twice, like, dude, just play the music. Don't worry about jumping around, please. Like, we're just trying to, and he was just like act like the very, this was the very first time he ever met them. And he's like actively fighting them on it. He's like, oh, 1200 hours, man. We got to play a show. I got to be show ready right now.
Yeah. Have you guys ever had I know that a lot of listeners have probably had this, but have you ever tried playing music with somebody that you have never, you don't really know, you've never played music with them before?
Many times.
Oh, yeah.
It's just, sometimes that happens. Sometimes you walk into a strange room with people you don't know and just, you're immediately in the pit of despair.
You just realize you've made a terrible mistake and there's no easy way out.
Like, honestly, what you should do, and what makes it so difficult is you spent all this time laying out your equipment, that it's going to take some time to collect all of that. There's no non-awkward way to get out the door. You're in the thick of it for the time being, and you just have to grin and bear it until you can finally remove yourself from this terrible situation that you put yourself in.
I had one time, this was a few years ago, I went to just try out with another band, and didn't know these people. It was at someone's house, fair enough. Everyone was pleasant. We just kind of hung out and talked, and one of them like started barbecuing, was making food for people, and it was all nice. But like time kept going and going. It's like, are we actually going to like jam at all? Is anything going to go on? And a couple of them like went into their little jam room, which was like a bedroom with nothing in it. And I'm just kind of like waiting for them to like have me come in. And finally I do, which is at this point I find out they already have a vocalist and they want two vocalists. It's like, oh, okay. But the thing that struck me the most was that this room had no windows. And these guys have been playing metal for a long time in it, and it just absolutely stunk.
It just smells you don't have to smell, you know?
Just sweat and BO, and I'm just like, all right, I'm going to do one song, and I'm getting the fuck out of here.
Yeah, in my previous band, we had a big practice space. It was large. It wasn't small, but it was windowless, and like it was so fucking hot in there, and so we'd get all sweaty, and both of them thought it was extremely funny to just like fart out loud. And so you just, oh my God, just stewing in that air for more than an hour was hell every time.
Maybe this is maybe a quirk of mine, but I typically hate that kind of behavior. Like, just keep it to yourself, bro. Don't do that shit around me.
Oh, they were huge bros. Like, they love to shit on me and each other and just like just fart and wave it in people's faces. They were just fucking like that.
Yeah. Some people never grow out of that,
right? It's just like, honestly, I mean, I like the music we played, but I was like, all right guys, I don't love you that much, goodbye.
I found a guy on Craigslist in college that was interested in playing some music, and I communicated with him. The idea was that we would both learn a couple of songs and we'd meet up. And I went over to his place, and he had found a drummer, and unbeknownst to me, that instead of playing the songs that I had learned for this, they were interested in doing like an Atreyu type thing. And I was just like, I have to leave. This is not it. This is not it at all.
Yeah, man.
I had one time where I didn't follow through on this, but it was like a Craigslist thing. And this guy was a drummer, and the name, like his name just kept ringing in my head. I'm like, where do I know this from? Where do I know this guy's name from? And but a day before I went to go jam with him, I realized that there was a local police blotter article about the guy who was arrested for playing his drums too loudly in his apartment and had to be like dragged out by the police. And I'm just like, oh, you know what? I actually joined another band. Sorry, dude.
Ah, bummer. Bummer.
This is a conversation that I've wanted to bring up for a long time. And I know that when we get more towards the end of the episode, that's really when the real problematic hours come out. But
accurate.
I've always wanted, because something that I see a lot that happens in progressive circles is there's a lot of finger pointing in terms of who was in what band with who. And I think a lot of people don't realize what it's like to meet some of these guys and how sometimes you awkwardly meet some dude on Craigslist and your entire lifespan of being in a band with these guys is just, they're just awkward guys you met on Craigslist, and you have no background on them, and you have no inkling to learn any background on them. You're just there to kind of riff out in a room that you all agree to play together in. And it happens all the time. And
sometimes you become really good friends with the people that you play music with, but I have found that is not always the case.
Certainly. And I mean, imagine if you are in sort of like a cancellation sort of controversy because you played in a band with the kind of guy that these guys are trying to play, and he's the one who's on bass. Like, imagine if that's the dude that gets you in trouble.
Yeah. That's a good point, and something we should maybe think about in the future. Like, maybe you just ended up in a really bad situation because of Craigslist.
but getting back to the topic at hand, of course.
So thank you for reminding me of that scene. Incredible stuff. They do find their real replacement, though. This insane fella that used to play in the band with the Paul Stanley character. He had gotten sober and went to Hawaii. Jesus Christ, the interview with him where he's like, I had gotten control of my substance abuse issues. And I'm sorry, what was the question? Just incredible, incredible footage. And what we follow is 24 hours of him preparing for a show that is just some of the most harrowing tape ever committed to film.
So it's important to mention that the Paul Stanley guy says that the show is sold out. It's a sold out Halloween show. So it's a big deal. They have to get their lights, their light up Kiss sign, their smoke machines, all their outfits, which they actually, I think they said that they bought the Kiss outfit from their former Gene Simmons.
Yes. And so we get to see this replacement Gene Simmons that is not nearly as fit as the previous one in the battle of getting him in his codpiece.
Where he gets like mad and frustrated, like, what's going on? What's the problem?
You're fat, dude. <That's it. laughs>
They're just trying to put the thing on you and it doesn't really fit. Give it a minute.
It's a huge production of getting everything in the van, getting to the venue, setting up, doing a sound check that pisses everybody off, being concerned that the ceiling is too low to do a proper fire breathing technique.
Which is terrifying to think of, as I live not that far from where the station fire was.
No, I kept thinking, like, are we about to see like a Great White scenario here? Fortunately, no. Just, and everybody is just being the biggest goddamn prima donna. Like, I can't work with this man. I can't, he doesn't understand what it takes to be in Kiss.
I mean, I couldn't help but feel for the guy. They fucking super glued the wig to his head to make sure it wouldn't fall off.
Oh man, that was brutal, actually.
They're like, oh, it's just two dots. It's just two dots. It won't hurt. I'll just put it right here. He's like, how would it not hurt? How would it possibly not hurt?
Right before showtime, they all they do a huddle. They put their hands in. They're like, that was it, man. That was the energy we needed. We got out there ready to fucking rock, man. And watching them go out on stage and the camera just so perfectly framed to see them coming out to smoke and lights for maybe 15 people.
Sold out show.
And they're rocking, bro. They're up, they're on stage, they're doing the moves, they're breathing the fire, they're living the dream, they're being Kiss. And they're slapping hands afterwards and they're taking pictures with 15 people that really enjoyed the show. And they're high on life. This is what they needed to carry them through the drudgery of having to live as a 40-something-year-old man who things didn't really work out for. And it's tragic and it's comic and it's, you really couldn't get a better depiction of this lifestyle if you wrote it yourself. It is an incredible piece of documentary magic. What was your takeaway from it?
I mean, we can say what we want about 15 people showing up for this one show they were talking about, but I'm sure you guys caught when they did that typical documentary thing where they give you like the current rundown of where everybody's at in life. They were saying that Larger Than Life typically brings home $5,000 a night when they play in California, which just it just made me start looking up white and black makeup. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, $5,000, that is a lot of money, but I'm sure that they also have restrictions on when and where they can play, as to not saturate the market and all that shit. And their stage show is no joke. They have an entire fucking rig that's in a huge truck that they have to carry with them. You know, you have to have accommodations and all that stuff. These guys are definitely not sleeping in the van.
But as far as, like, the overall documentary... As Jordan kind of pointed out earlier, I think it's really interesting to kind of watch how these guys live out this rock star fantasy on stage in strict contrast to how the rest of their life kind of goes. And I think it was really important for them to kind of highlight those two different worlds. And I think the people who made the documentary, produced it, did a really good job at that. But man, it really bums you out to hear how a lot of these guys feel as they go through it, and how, you know, it feels like these guys started cover bands because they tried to do the real thing themselves with their own original music. And it just worked out so poorly for a lot of them that they just kind of decided to just go, fuck it, I'll just do what works. And then to see that that's what works, that people are willing to pay you $5,000 a night to play music from a band that already exists and already has their own stage show and everything else. It's just, it's kind of a kick in the dick if you're somebody who has any sort of form of aspiration in terms of, you know, your own original music.
I mean, I see the appeal. If you're just kind of an aging schlub, like, and you can't let go of your adolescent fantasies, like, this is the way to check all those boxes and tickle that itch, I guess, before you have to go back to being, I don't know, like a day trader or whatever the fuck it is that some of these guys do.
At least I'm not super fan.
What do you think, Jordan?
I'm just glad that I was able to bring this into your lives, something new that you hadn't seen before. Like I've said, I've seen this a whole bunch of times. It is that weird documentary mixture of funny and cringe and sad. You know, at the end of the day, it does make me feel a little bit better about myself and performing my own music. It's like, well, at least I know my place in the music world. And it's like, yeah, maybe I don't play to that many people and only a handful of people like it, but I'd rather just be doing what I want to do than playing dress up and playing in front of the same amount of people and just stressing about the sound of my Kiss cover band and things like that. So it makes me feel better about myself, and it sent me down this rabbit hole of looking up like local tribute acts, because we have a bunch by me, and it reminded me that we have a Rage Against the Machine being one that calls themselves Balls on Parade.
Oh no.
And there's I found a YouTube video, and they like dress up like them, and the video is them playing in front of no one in some sort of dive bar, and it's just like, I'm good, I'm okay.
I hate that so much.
I think the thing that I hated the most about playing music was playing live. So this is such a strange thing to me that's basically all these guys want. They want the live show experience. They want people like coming up after them and after the show and telling them how great they are. And that's awful to me. Just the worst thing.
Well, it's the praise and the adulation that they never got with their own bands and their own boring menial jobs. For 45 minutes, they're a star.
I guess that's enough. It's a life I don't truly understand and definitely don't want. But for an hour and a half, this was a great experience of living out the lives of people that this is all they need.
I was going to say, I wonder what all these people are up to now if they're still alive.
That's a great question. I would like to revisit all of these people, every one of them, especially Superfan.
Superfan specifically, yeah.
Just find out Superfan was the Las Vegas shooter.
So I was just going to say, we're about time, fellas. Is there any additional closing thoughts, or can we wrap this bad boy up?
I got nothing. I had a great time. I hope you all did too.
We mentioned Tool cover bands, and I wanted to tell this story before we finish. I was at a heavy metal themed chicken wing place that Brando, I took you to when you came down here, maybe about a year or two ago, and sitting in the booth waiting for my food, and behind me was a whole bunch of dudes, and every time someone would come up, waitress, a server, someone walking by, they would ask, "Do you like Tool?" And they wait for the answer to say, "We're in a Tool cover band, and we're playing with next week, and we're selling tickets." And anyone that would walk past them, they just have a conversation about Tool. So during my entire meal, I had to hear this over and over and over again. Finish my food, pay, get up to leave, and one of them says, "Hey, do you like Tool?" And I said, "Not really." And he starts going into his spiel about the band. I'm like, "I know, I heard you," and then walked out.
Like, imagine the compound sadness of having a cover band nobody wants to see.
It just sucks having to sell tickets for your pay-to-play cover gig. the story here is don't play music.
don't play anything ever. Don't get a guitar for Christmas. Get a PlayStation. It's fine.
Probably be happier.
A lot happier. All right, boys, you guys, you've been great. Keep it metal. We will see you next week. Stay indoors, stay safe. And, be sure to check us out on patreon.com/toolitofhell. And if you're interested in checking out the documentary, currently it is somewhere on YouTube illegally. Just type in tribute documentary. I'm sure you'll find it. Have a great time. We'll see you later.
Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to 66.6 FM, Radio TOVH, The Flush.